Today we're going to be talking about the wedding in Cana. And it's no secret that people wonder this question, where is God? People in America think it because when we ask them, they say, I don't believe in God, or God doesn't exist. So we must conclude that they've given enough thought to know for certain that God doesn't exist, right? New York Times devoted a whole magazine to the topic, God is dead. Which in itself is a funny thing because they have not produced a body to do an autopsy to make this sort of statement. But I want to tell you the story of a man who did that or raised that question of, where is God? Can we find God? The story of a man named Lee. He said, I'm going to find God. And so he thought, where am I going to find him? Where am I going to find God? And so he says, okay, the first place I should look is where people claim God is, at his church. So he goes to the church, and when he gets there, he sees people fighting, people bickering at one another for what's going on, whatever is going on. And so he concludes, God's not there. I don't see how God could be there. So then he says, okay, where's the next place? People say, well, if I go out in nature, I see God. So he goes out to the mountains. It's beautiful, but I don't see God anywhere. So then he goes to the ocean, the beach. Vast and calming, but I don't see God anywhere, right? Goes on to the family. Goes and observes families. He sees mom and dad fighting a lot. Probably not where God's going to be. Then he goes to a wedding. He sees people getting married, and it's a beautiful thing, but I don't see God. I haven't been able to find God. Goes to a youth rally, and all he could see was kids cutting up. No one's paying attention. Everybody's goofing off with their neighbor, talking, not paying attention to what's going on. So, again, no, I don't see God there. Goes to a playground. He sees kids, and it's a wonderful thing, but I don't see God there. So he got desperate. So he decides, I'm going to go to where you find justice, because God is justice, is what I've been told. But all he could see was injustice happening. People coming, trying to pull the wool over the government's face that the truth is not found out, and the wicked go unpunished. So he did not find God there. On his way home, he saw a car wreck. And he thought, well, if God wasn't there, he's not going to be in any of the other of those places. Why would I expect him to possibly be here? But he saw a man with a Bible rushing in. He watches as this man works, goes about helping people who are in the wreck, the victims of the crash. And afterwards, he goes and talks to this guy, tells him his plight of he's trying to find God. And the man encourages him to go back and find God. It's hard to see God in the bad things. Not much is true, but you got to look hard. And he says it's also still harder to remember God when you're not in need of him. So he goes back to the court. He sees what he saw before of injustice happening, but he sees something he didn't notice before. He sees a judge who truthfully is trying to give justice to those who are coming to him. So he says, you know what? There is justice going on. Maybe there is a way I can find God. I can see God's justice, at least a part of it, breaking through. So he goes back to the playground and he sees how beautiful this creation is. And truly, if indeed it was created, there is a marvelous, incomprehensible being who has created this to make something so wonderful. So he starts to see, okay, maybe I should go back and look a little bit deeper with the other places. He goes back to the youth rally and he sees God using people. We have all those students that don't know God. They're trying to raise them to know who God is, who their creator is. He sees that there's people making that effort of trying to crack the ice between these kids and their creator, the wall between them of they don't know God. They want to teach these kids to know who created them. He goes back to the wedding. He stays long enough to hear the presider talk about the third person involved in this marriage that's going to happen, and that's God. The promise is made to God as well as to each other that you're going to be married. And he sees that God is a part of marriage, right? He goes back to the family, and he says, yes, mom and dad are indeed fighting. They mess up. They're human, but they're trying, truthfully trying, to raise their kids to know God and who He is. Goes back to the beaches and the mountains. And he realizes how big creation is, looking at how complex this is. And compared to him, if there is something that created this, he must be pretty big. So he goes back to the church where people were fighting. And yes, they were fighting over a pointless issue, but these are people who have realized they're not perfect. They're never going to be perfect, but that's not what makes them able to follow Christ. They want to honor their Creator. They know they're going to mess up, but they want to do their best to give God the glory that He deserves. They want to know Him. That's kind of the story I have leading up to this. So we get into our text here. I want to talk about the elephant in the room of the wedding at Cana, all right? Jesus did make wine, okay? I'm not advocating alcohol as good or bad, but I do want to deal with what the Bible says. And the Bible deals heavily with don't get drunk, okay? That's the point the Bible makes. Obviously, we need to deal with drunkenness as seriously and as carefully as we can. I would caution all of you to err on the side of caution. I wouldn't suggest wading into, okay, how close can I get before I feel this becomes a sin? Try and stay away, far away from that as you can. There's plenty of other issues in our life that we aren't so in control of. Don't wade into that area where you're questioning, is this okay or not? Now, this was a custom, and I briefly want to talk about it, is in this day and age to use alcohol because of the dirtiness of their water, difficulty with clean water. They had bacteria that the wine would kill that we don't have to deal with today because of how we clean our water. Along with it, it has a different taste than water. You didn't just get tired of just one flavor all the time. Some different things that might help as well is knowing what they did. They would drink their wine as three parts water and one part wine. So it's only about 25%. It's very watered down. As well as in a wedding, it was not allowed for anyone to get drunk. If you got drunk, you were thrown out. All right. There were men that were specifically stationed to do that. We would consider them bouncers. But that's kind of a smaller issue I wanted to touch on. The bigger issue is, let's set this up here. Let's talk about Jesus. It's perhaps Tuesday, it's the third day of the week, as our text says. Who has a wedding on a Tuesday, I must ask, but it's on a Tuesday, and Jesus has been invited to a wedding. He says, he was told, bring your friends, your disciples are able to come too. So, going to a party, going to a wedding, what do you bring? Typically, you bring a gift, right? Probably an empty stomach, because maybe they serve food at the wedding, there's drinks there as well, right? This newlywed couple apparently were not party planners. They didn't spend enough time and money getting drinks and food because they ran out. Number one, they ran out. Number two, Jesus' Minute Maid stuff was a lot better than what they had come up with. But we'll get to that. The point is, they ran out of wine. And now this is a bad omen because it's almost like seeing the bride before the wedding. It's a bad omen for that to happen. You can't even prepare enough drinks for your guests on your happiest day. How bad is that going to be? And apparently Mother Mary was close to the family, and like any good friend, she volunteers what she has. She almost leans over to Jesus and says, "Son, I need you to run to the store and get some milk for me," right? Sort of that mentality. She goes to Jesus and says, "They've run out of wine." And in verse 4, Jesus says to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." And I want to deal with that statement he makes here of my hour has not yet come. Mary, no doubt, is a proud mother. She has an inkling of his ability as kind of is portrayed here. But Jesus makes a statement that keeps being used. My hour has not yet come. The reason for saying this is can be a little bit difficult. It seems that Jesus is saying is, this is where the ministry starts when this first miracle happens. And if you're going to draw that out, it means the clock is now ticking almost. Once the door is open, the journey is on. This first miracle is kind of once you open that can of worms, you can't re-close it, really. We get this history from John, and he puts it as his first miracle that he tells. Now we jump back to the text in verse 5. Mary tells the people there, do whatever he says. We don't know many details about Jesus up to this point of his life, but apparently Mary knew something. Verse 6, now there were six stone water jars for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. We're given some detail about these jars. They were used for a specific purpose, this Jewish rite of purification. And we wonder, what is that? Well, whenever Jesus talks about you wash the cup inside and out, or you wash the outside of the cup, but the inside is dirty. He talks about you guys have the nicest tombs, but inside is full of dead people. You're whitewashed tombs. This is kind of the thing, is they would wash the cup with water, but they didn't clean the inside of it. That's kind of the same purification rite that Jesus is talking about here. It's a reference of washing cups and pitchers. They were used to make things clean. All right. Now, probably a huge point we can know is that these jars, there would be no other substance besides water in them. They were not allowed to be used for that. It would be a huge problem if they were. So we know that there's nothing mixed in here to which you can point to and say that it was a fake miracle. That tied with verse 7, he says, fill it to the brim. We know that there was no additive given to it. Simply that Jesus indeed made a miracle happen here. After they had followed Jesus' direction, he said, take some to the master of the feast. Now, the master is likely the groom's father. And so they do, and the groom's father didn't know who had made this. So he has a little father-son talk about honorable hosts and what you should be doing. But he doesn't know where the wine came from and was made by God himself. And he says in verse 10, everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now. Now, maybe this man's not too far off of a thought of the good first, all right? He says, good things first, then the not so good. Isn't that what God tells us to do with our lives? Matthew 6, verse 33 says, seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. He says, seek God first. Put the good things first. Kind of the idea we can draw from this, I think, is a applicable idea of putting God at the forefront whenever we think of doing things. You may think we get things twisted around where we aren't putting the first things first in our life, of putting what's important first. Sometimes it gets lost in the shuffle of life. John writes this knowing there will come a time when he will no longer be on this earth, and the people that he has raised to know Jesus will need some encouragement. So he writes these things down. This is the point of John's gospel, he says in chapter 20, verse 31, so that we may believe Jesus is the Son of God. And once we learn this, we'll conclude, if Jesus is God's Son, then I need to listen to what he says. It's important what he says. Something to this point is, wine is defined as good wine, okay? The wine that God gave, all right? The good stuff. I just want to point to God makes things good, okay? Having God in the relationship, having God in your life makes things good. Sometimes we don't appreciate that. Sometimes we don't stop to think about that. But having God in your life is a good thing, right? Now, that doesn't mean that he makes life easy. He doesn't mean that whenever you pray for something, just because you pray for it, God's going to give it to you. God gives you what's you should have. He doesn't give you something that's going to be dangerous to you. But it gives meaning to life. Meaning that when we get to the end of the rainbow, when you get to the bottom of the barrel, really, you aren't pulled up wanting more still. When you look at it, you see in the movies, people are chasing after money and they are chasing after wealth or something else, and they get to, they have it. They kind of always turn away and say, it's not what I thought it was going to be. We see oftentimes in real life, whenever somebody does it, they decide, I'm going to end my life because what I've wasted all my time for, it's not all what's cracked up to be. But that's not what it's like with God. When people find God, it becomes more to them. It becomes so valuable, they don't want to ever let go of it. And that's the thing of God makes life worth having. John ends with verse 11. This is the first of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. God's there in the good times, not just the bad. Oftentimes we think of, okay, when do I need God? It's when I need something from God. I think we would do well to go and look for God in each situation in our lives so that we see God in the morning, at lunchtime, at dinner, at night, when we're working, when we're at school, when things are good, when things are bad. Seeing God in every situation is an important part because He's there. I think it's important because Matthew chapter 5, verse 14 says, this is Jesus saying, "You are the light of the world." Now, we'll be coming to that passage, so I don't want to give too much details about it yet. But I think there's a point that we need to see. Light of the world and seeking to find God in every situation. This world is hurting. This world is in darkness. I don't think it takes much to see that in this world today. You just turn on the news or you look around, you see people who are hurting. God wants us to help these people. He wants us to shine our light so that people can see. We oftentimes talk about we can shine our light so that people can see the ugliness of sin. But I think we can also shine our lights and show people the good, that is, God. We can shine our lights to show where God is, but we can't do that if we don't know where God is in each situation. If we haven't looked to see, I know where God is. I want to point you in the right direction. If we don't know ourselves how to know God's there, we're not going to be able to point Him out to others. I want to say, I see a world in need of God. Let's look at a bit of the darker places to find God. How about the bar scene? There are many people that go there because they're hurting. There are people that are going there because they've been spited for some reason or another. They've not been shown love and they're hurting right now because of that. We can see God wants us to go and shine light in that situation, to show love where they have been missing it. What about divorce court? There's couples that are coming out that maybe don't know what love is supposed to look like, the way that God set it up. We're able to help people to see this is the love that God has appointed us to have, not what the world teaches, right? What about food pantries? There's people that have fallen in hard times. They don't have many people having their back to help them through these situations. We can do that. We can help to shine a light. We can help people to see who God is and why God is good through those situations. And God says, I put you on this earth with abilities and gifts. I have given you my Spirit to guide you. I want you to do something about it. This is an amazing task. It's difficult, yes, but it's wonderfully worth it to tackle this task that God has given. How about this story? An appointment with love. 6 minutes to six. The great round clock over the information booth at Grand Central Station says, a tall, young Army lieutenant who had just come from the direction of the tracks lifted his sunburned face and his eyes narrowed as he tried to see the exact time. His heart was pounding with a beat that shocked him himself because he could not control it. In 6 minutes, he would see the woman who had filled a special place in his life for the last 13 months. The woman he had never seen, yet whose written words had been with him and helped to sustain him through this hard time. He placed himself as close as he could to the information booth, just beyond the ring of people bothering the clerks, really. Lieutenant Blanford remembered one night in particular of the worst fighting. When his plane had been caught in the midst of a pack of Zeros, it's a term, I guess, for air fight, he had seen the grinning face of one of the enemy pilots. In one of his letters, he had confessed to her that he had often felt fear. And only a few days before this battle, he had received her answer. She said, "Of course you fear. All brave men do. Didn't King David know fear? That's why he wrote the 23rd Psalm. Next time you doubt yourself, I want you to hear my voice reciting to you, 'Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for you are with me.'" And he remembered, and he had heard her imagined voice, and it renewed his strength. Now he was going to hear her voice for the real first time. 4 minutes to six. His eyes grew sharp. Under the immense starred roof, people were walking fast like threads of color against gray. A girl passed close to him, and Lieutenant Blanford stared. She was wearing a red flower in her suit lapel, but it was a crimson sweet pea, but not the little red rose they had agreed upon. Besides, this girl was too young, about 18, whereas Hollis Manel had frankly told him she was 30. Well, what of it? He had answered. I'm 32. Really, he was 29. His mind went back to that book, the book the Lord himself must have put in his hands. Out of all the hundreds of Army library books that had been sent to Florida, this one had been handed to him, of human bondage. And throughout the book, there were notes of a woman's writing. And he had always hated notes in books, but these remarks were different. He had never believed that a woman could see into a man's heart so tenderly and so understandingly. Her name was in the book, Hollis Manel, and he had gotten a hold of a New York City telephone book and had found her address and had written her, and she had answered. The next day, he had been shipped out, and they had gone on writing. For 13 months, she had faithfully replied. When his letters did not come, she wrote anyways. And now he believed he loved her and she loved him. But she had refused all his pleas to send him her photograph. That seemed rather bad, of course, but she explained, if you feel for me has any reality, any honest basis, what I look like won't matter. Suppose I'm beautiful. I'd always be haunted by the feeling that you had been taking a chance on just that. And that kind of love would disgust me. Suppose I'm plain and you must admit this is more likely than the other. Then I'd always fear that you were just writing to me because you had no one else to write to. No, don't ask for my picture. When you come to New York, you will see me. And then you can make up your decision. Remember, both of us are free to stop or go at that point, whichever we choose. 1 minute to six. Lieutenant Blandford's heart leaped higher than his plane had ever done. A young woman was coming towards him. Her figure was long and slim. Her hair lay back in curls from her delicate ears. Her eyes were blue. Her chin and lips had a gentle firmness. Her pale green suit, she was like springtime come alive. He started toward her, entirely forgetting to notice that she had no rose. And as he moved, a small, provocative smile curved her lips. And she said, "Going my way, soldier?" Uncontrollably, he made one more step closer to her, and then he saw Hollis Manel. She was standing almost directly behind the girl. She was a woman well past 40, her gray hair tucked under her worn hat. Her feet were thrust into low-heeled shoes, but she wore a red rose in the rumpled lapel of her brown coat. The girl in the green suit was walking away quickly, and Blandford felt as though he were split in two. So keen was his desire to follow the girl, yet so deep was his longing for the woman whose spirit had truly companioned and upheld his own for so long. And there she stood, her pale face, gentle and sensible. He could see that now. Her gray eyes had a warm, kindly twinkle, and Lieutenant Blandford did not hesitate. His fingers gripped the small, worn, blue leather copy of Human Bondage, which was to identify him to her. This would not be love, but it would be something precious, something perhaps rarer than love, a friendship for which he had been and must be ever grateful. He squared his broad shoulders and saluted her and held out the book toward the woman. Although while he did this, he felt a shock of bitterness of his own disappointment. He said, "I'm Lieutenant John Blandford, and you must be Miss Manel. I'm so glad to meet you. May I take you to dinner?" The woman's face broadened into a tolerant smile. She said, "I don't know what this is all about, son," she answered. "That young lady in the green suit who just went by begged me to wear this rose on my coat. She said that if you asked me to go out with you, I should tell you she's waiting for you at the big restaurant across the street. She said it was some kind of a test. I've got two boys with Uncle Sam myself, so I don't mind to oblige you." Seeing God in those situations of doing the right thing and realizing it was worth it. Realizing what's important in life. Realizing God is there. Realizing God has a purpose. God handed that book to him so that they met. Is what it's kind of a point towards. How about this one? An afternoon in the park. There once was a little boy who wanted to meet God, and he knew it was a long way away, so he packed his suitcase with Twinkies and a six-pack of root beer, and he began his journey. When he had gone about three blocks, he met an old woman. She was sitting in the park just staring at some pigeons. The boy sat down next to her and opened his suitcase. He was about to take a drink from his root beer when he noticed the old lady looked hungry. and so he offered her a Twinkie. She gratefully accepted it and smiled at him. Her smile was so pretty that the boy wanted to see it again, so he offered her a root beer. Once again, she smiled at him, and the boy was delighted. They sat there all afternoon eating and smiling, but they never said a word to each other. As it grew dark, the boy realized how tired he was, and he got up to leave. But before he had gone more than a few steps, he turned around and ran back and hugged her. She gave him the biggest smile she had ever given the boy yet. When the boy opened the door to his own house, a short time later, his mother was surprised by the look of joy that was on his face. She asked him, "What did you do today that made you smile so much?" And he replied, "I had lunch with God." Before his mother could respond, he added, "You know what? She's got to have the most beautiful smile I've ever seen." Meanwhile, the old woman, also radiant with joy, returned to her home. Her son was stunned by the look of peace on her face, and he asked her, "Mother, what did you do today that made you so happy?" And she replied, "I ate Twinkies in the park with God today." Before her son responded, she added, "You know, he's much younger than I expected." Finding God in everyday life. It's an important part of Christians that we learn to see God in every situation. And this, the point is, we're also able to help our fellow man to see God and to see the need of having God in our lives. That's the charge. God says, "Come to me for life." The invitation is come to know God. The invitation is open to everybody, whether you want to be a first-time Christian or you need to renew yourself because you've fallen away. The invitation is open as we stand and sing this next song.